Hey y'all.
How's it going?
Well, good.
I guess. I mean, I assume that you answered positively. We're doing great, Scott. I imagined you all saying. All right. Well, I'm Scott. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I was trying to call in sick this morning, but I couldn't get a hold of Ian, and I couldn't get a hold of Daryl, and I couldn't take the risk that LRN's network feed was just going to put out dead air for 3 hours, you know, with commercial breaks. And I'm not sure. I actually think they probably have it set up where if I didn't sign on, that it would probably just replay yesterday's show or last Friday's show, right? But I don't know. I couldn't get a hold of anybody to tell me. So, you guys are stuck with Rundown Scott today. It's the Rundown Scott Horton show. As you can tell, my throat hurts like hell. Oh, okay, cool. Well, I screwed up, but I hope it works. Oh, crap. You know what? I'm double booked. See, this is the other problem, is I didn't start putting the show together until too damn late. Here, let me write an email. How about, aw, crap, can I move you to 1:30? Aw, crap, can I move you to 1:30? Sorry. You know what, that's not going to work. I'm better off asking Ray to move than Trevor. Yeah, well, I'll have to hold back on answering Trevor until I hear back from Ray. That's what we'll do. Yeah, that's what we'll do. I'll write Ray right now, and I'll call him at the break. See, that sucks, though, because I bumped him for Patrick last Friday. Now I'm bumping him. Well, I just want to bump him to a different time, not right the hell off the show like last week. So that's okay, right? Plus, Ray's a real sweet guy, man. He don't care. I mean, assuming he's available. Oops. I'm double booked. Yes, I really suck at broadcasting. I really suck at arranging radio show interviews. I suck at this. I have an impeccable taste in guests. Otherwise, there's, you know, not much to admire. But anyway, here I am writing an email live on the show. Oops, I'm double booked. Can I move you to 1 or 1:30 Eastern. I am the worst at this. Well, whatever. Ray may be on the show. Trevor Tim will be on the show today. I've been trying to get Trevor on the show since I don't even know when. I says to Trevor today, I says, can you do this time or that time? He says, I thought we were already on for 2 o'clock. I'm sure he's right. The hell do I know? But that's when I had scheduled Ray. Today on the show, some combination of Trevor Tim, Ray McGovern, and Gareth Porter. Now, Gareth, yes, it's true. I interviewed him Saturday for my KPFK show on Sunday. I hope you got to hear it. Played yesterday morning on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, and the archive is at scotthorton.org. And it's really good because it's Gareth. And he's got this great exclusive. He went and interviewed the Iranian foreign minister, who said to him that, yeah, we're willing to negotiate a situation where, even if we're ramping up enrichment, you know, overall numbers of cascades and that kind of thing, we're willing to convert our uranium hexafluoride gas, enriched up to 3.5%, 3.6%. We're willing to convert that immediately into oxidized powder form, ready to ship off to the Russians to be made into fuel plates. So in other words, just like they did with their 20%, they oxidized it all and converted it to fuel plates. So point being that now they can't possibly enrich it up to weapons grade. They've taken their breakout stockpile and they've way reduced it, and now they're offering to basically eliminate it. They want to still keep spinning centrifuges, but they have a deal to oxidize all of it and make it impossible for it to be further enriched up to weapons grade, which is above 94%, really. People say above 90%, but it's really got to be 94-95% to make a nuclear bomb out of it, at least one that's any quote-unquote good. But anyway, so that's a huge story on the Iran nuclear deal. Gareth Porter wrote it for IPS, and he's got a couple of more like that, too. Well, why is this open? He's got a couple of more like that, too. One about David Albright being a liar. Not Gareth's. And then another one about the laptop documents. And then another one about part of the IAEA investigation. Now, I don't know. I guess I could see how to some people this is boring or whatever. But for me, I mean, I got to learn it anyway. And Gareth is the best on it. And the thing of it is that it's a real important small issue within the whole, you know, drummed up nuclear fake controversy here about Iran's nuclear program. Part of it is this endless IAEA investigation, not under the safeguards agreement, but mandated by the UN Security Council, that says that Iran has to answer 10 million questions based on Israeli forgeries and whatever other innuendos David Sanger made up in the New York Times and whatever the hell. And in this case, it's a specific part of the deal where they really have, you know, in actuality, they've closed the book on one of these questions, and yet they won't close the book on it, you know, technically speaking, because they need their issue. And so then this brings up the corruption of Yuki Amano, the new head of the IAEA who replaced Mohammed El-Baradei, and who's revealed by the American hero Chelsea Manning in the WikiLeaks to have climbed down on his knees and disgraced the family name Amano forever and ever and ever by bowing and scraping before his superior American masters and declaring that whatever lie that they have on the agenda, he'll be happy to carry their water. We'll have the... In fact, I should pull up the exact translation. You know what? Here's Kerry on Iraq. Let's listen to this for a second. Give my throat a rest.
Primarily on the ability of Iraq's leaders to come together and take a stand united against ISIL.
U.S. officials emphasize...
Oh, okay. Well, I'm sorry. I thought he was... I thought that was just him talking. He did give a talk earlier. Kerry went to Iraq, met with Maliki. And then the headline from antiwar.com is, Kerry, support to Iraq to be, quote, intense and sustained. Now, whether they're really overthrowing Maliki at this point or not, I don't know. They may have backed down from that. It seemed like they were wanting to demand that Maliki step down. The goddamn Ayatollah Sistani said that he should step down. But then the Ayatollah Khamenei, who is a lower-ranking religious figure, but who holds the political supreme leader position in Iran, basically disagreed with that, didn't argue with Sistani specifically, but said that it's, you know, the Americans want to get rid of Maliki and replace him with an American puppet. So I don't know what's going on there. And then freaking Mictad al-Sadr sent his spokesman forward to threaten the Americans that they better not come back. Mictad al-Sadr being the most powerful grassroots boss of a militia on the Shiite side. He's not one of these, hotel expats who, lived in downtown Tehran for 30 years, ever since Jimmy Carter hired Saddam Hussein to invade Iran for him back in 1980. This is a guy who lived there through the worst of times with everybody else in Sadr City, which is named after his father. And he sent his guy over to... He sent one of his guys out to threaten the Americans to not come back. We'll see how it goes. Back in a sec. I didn't know how much time I had. I had that port turned down. Oops. Hey,
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement, featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more. The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty, and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you.
All right, you guys, welcome back. It's the Scott Horton Show. So it looks like I got Trevor lined up for 2. I got Ray for 1:30. I still actually have a couple more invites out. At least one more invite out. Tomorrow on the show, Will Grigg. And also tomorrow on the show, Peter Van Buren. And I don't know. I think that's all I know so far. So that'd be cool. Alright, so, man, there's so much to say about the Iraq stuff. It's hard for me to pick and choose, but I guess, well, I got a couple of things here. The first thing I want to say is that, I don't know, if you heard my interview with Jonathan Landay last week, this is one example, but it's come up in the other ones too. He kind of got sidetracked off on these damned warmongers all over the TV. All of the exact same people from Cheney's Gestapo office, as Colin Powell called it. This separate coup d'etat, neocon, Ariel Sharon government within a government in the George W. Bush years. Every single one of these guys gets to go on TV, which that's not what Landay called it. That's... That's my interpretation. Every one of these guys gets called on to be an expert. And he actually did reliable sources on CNN this weekend. One of the things he complained about, I complained about, they've never even heard of him. They don't even know who Landay is. The guy that got Iraq right, him and John Wolcott and Warren Strobel at Knight Ridder Newspapers. They did a kick-ass job in 2001, 2002, 2003, saying this is all a bunch of crap. They reported the fact that this is all a bunch of crap the whole time. I mean, we're talking from late September 2001 on. Landay is writing about, geez, I got CIA guys coming to me and saying this is a bunch of crap. They're going to Iraq and they're making up reasons why. From the very beginning, Landay got it right, and we hadn't seen hide nor hair of him in the media this whole time. Finally gets invited on Reliable Sources, and they ask him, so, how do you like this, how do you like all the neocons? In fact, they quote Maddow saying, none of the people who lied us into war or who were involved in the Bush administration's push for war, the neoconservative movement, none of them should be brought on TV as experts at all. And Landay says, well, no, I mean, he's not against, you know, having a rule like that or anything, but they should have to answer for what they've did, for what they've done before they get to carry on recommending the next phase of the policy. And of course, the real problem is there is that none of the people asking the questions know anything about it. You know, Megyn Kelly on Fox News has gotten a few headlines by challenging Cheney and challenging John Bolton and saying, oh, is that why you don't want to talk about any of the last 10 years? But she can't talk about any of the last 10 years. And neither can anyone at Fox, CNN, ABC, NBC, MSNBC. Rachel Maddow, she's a pretty educated type, Rhodes Scholar and all that crap. But do you think that she can break down and explain to you who's the Dawa Party and who's the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution? I mean, what did it mean for their revolution when the old man Aziz al-Hakim died and blah, blah, blah? Hell no. She can't ask a follow-up question based on what the Bader Brigade did in 2006 and why they did it and why Rumsfeld hired them to do it. She can't. She is unable. The fact is, there never was accountability for the neocons or for the media who helped the neocons lie us into this war. There never was accountability for any of them. And so, therefore, Landay is not the host of any of these shows. Landay is not, or he's also not the regular go-to, extremely well-paid, you know, CNN expert that they go to when they have questions like this. He's still over there at McClatchy, which might as well be a black hole as far as the halls of power are concerned. They don't read McClatchy newspapers in Washington, D.C. And so, you know, the situation is one where he's right that it should be okay to call Paul Bremer and have him on, but really only to mock him, ask him how to explain himself when, you know, this is so much his fault, and break out the talking points. They're easy, you know? Why'd you disband the army? Why'd you debothify the entire government? Not the people with power, but down to the school teachers? You debothified everything? You know, why did you think that it would be a great idea, or did you even know who Ayatollah Sistani was when you invaded the country? And what did you think was going to happen when he demanded one man, one vote for all Shia, two-thirds of the population of the country, and blah, 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 all that stuff? No one can ask him that, because no one at CNN knows the first thing about it to ask him. All this talk about Iran is on the side of the Maliki government, and so are we, that you've heard in the last 2 weeks. This is the first mention of that in a decade. Okay? America's been fighting for Iran and Iran's sock puppets in the Dawa Party and the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, later renamed the Iraqi Supreme Islamic Council, but whatever. Because they won their revolution. George Bush won their revolution for them, so they had to drop revolution from the name C. But America's been fighting for them since the first day of the war in 2003. And if you don't like that, sorry, punch yourself in the face or something. That's the truth. You can go read about it. Lande was on the show. He said last week, you know, he said something like, here we are fighting for the Iranians. And I said, we've been fighting for the Iranians since 03 when Abdulaziz al-Hakim came across the border. And Lande said, I was there. I watched him come across the border. Okay? We have been fighting. The U.S. government has been fighting for Iran in Iraq since the day Jonathan Lande saw Abdulaziz al-Hakim cross the border with his own naked eyes in March of 2003. And no one on TV knows that. None of them. None of their experts either. Maybe two or three of their experts. Maybe 1% of the experts even understand that. Even have the slightest idea who's who. And then when they asked, well, who should we have on? Who do they ask? They asked Peter Beinart. I'm talking about, again, on when Lande finally was invited onto CNN, Reliable Sources, over the weekend. They didn't ask Lande who should we talk to. They asked Peter Beinart, who as editor of the New Republic lied us into war, and who is genuinely sorry about it. But boy, did he lie us into war. And boy, wasn't the New Republic, you know, lining up for this thing one of the single most important factors in pushing America into that war that all acceptable centrist liberalism, as represented by the New Republic and by the Council on Foreign Relations, where O'Hanlon and what's his sidekick over there, the Siamese twins, Hanlon and his whatever the hell. Boy, wasn't it important. And Beinart put all this crap about Saddam and Al-Qaeda and weapons and whatever in the New Republic. It's just absolutely horrible. But then they ask him who to interview, and he says, well, how about Andrew Bacevich? And that sounds like a great idea to me. I'm pro-Bacevich, and he's no libertarian, but at least he's a critic. But man, there are so many other experts. How about Robert Dreyfus at The Nation? You know, Chris Hayes on MSNBC, that's where he comes from, The Nation. So don't tell me Bob Dreyfus is so outside the mainstream he's not welcome, but he's been writing about Hakim since 03.
The military-industrial complex. The disastrous rise of misplaced power.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State, by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot. Though in older times, it would disarm for a bit between each one. But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today. Corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world.
The Worst State by Michael Swanson, available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com. Or just click the logo in the right-hand margin at scotthorton.org.
We should take nothing for granted.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And yeah, chat room guys, tell me again about the rain here. It's coming down quite a bit harder now than it was. I want to make sure that you can't hear it on the mic, especially if anybody's wearing headphones. But I sure like having the window open when it's pouring down ass rain outside, which it is right now. Ooh, good for my lawn. It's not much of a lawn. It's probably the smallest lawn in Texas, but it needs water on it. All right. Oh, you know, the break came and interrupted me before I really got to my point. I'm sorry, I'm going on too long here. Well, I was talking about how there was no accountability. Thank you, guys. Can't hear it in headphones. Very good. Thank you very much. So the thing of it is this. There was no accountability for those who lied us into war. An aggressive war. They started a war. No accountability whatsoever. And then there is no accountability in the media either. And so now all those same people who lied us into war in the media are the same people who are interviewing all those who lied us into war on TV about what should be done about it. And here's where we get to the real point, isn't that, well, I'm angry because I would like to see my favorite interviewees interviewed on TV all the time, which is true. And I got a whole list. But that's not the real point. The real point is, so you see where we're stuck, where there's virtually no one on TV saying, you know, making a real case against intervention. Rand Paul made a kind of anti-interventionist case. Of course, he had to build in weasel words about supporting airstrikes anyway, because he just can't go without disappointing the hell out of me on a daily basis. But Rand said, look, this is already jihadist wonderland over there because of what America did over there. Oh, and Iran, they've gained an influence over there because of what America did over there. That's good. But he's lucky that Candy Crowley and David Gregory don't know anything about Iraq. Because if they tried to ask him informed follow-up questions about, oh, yeah, well, what do you mean by that? I think he'd be stuck. He explained himself pretty well on supporting the U.S. government should not have been supporting the rebels in Syria this whole time. Although when he referred to 6 months ago as the last time America gave them any help, I don't know what the hell he was talking about. Candy Crowley said, well, that's history. And he said, well, history is 6 months ago. He should have said that's history last week. Why don't you check up on America's U.N. ambassador and her announcements about the increased arms we're sending those guys. But anyway, point is, here's the real point. The real point is America turned North and Western Iraq into Sunni bin Ladenite jihadistan by invading in 03. Basically, they got way too big for their britches, and they worn out their welcome with the local Sunnis who had, you know, allowed them to help in the fight against the Americans. But they blew it because they directed their war against the Shiites and made it a civil war that the Sunni couldn't possibly win. And they got kicked out of Baghdad because they're 20% of the country, and the Shia are 60. The other 20 are the Kurds up in the north who are Sunnis but are a different ethnicity, and in this case were allied with the Shiites rather than allied with the Sunni Arabs. The bin Ladenites basically got the civil war good and lost for the Sunnis, who couldn't have won it anyway, but they really got them into it and really got them in a situation where they lost Baghdad. So then in 06 and 07, they turned on the Al-Qaeda guys and really tamped them down. But then when the Arab Spring came, Barack Obama embarked on this policy. In his own words, it's all about taking Iran down a peg. His own people talked to the New York Times, said this is all about taking Iran down a peg. He said in his own words to Jeffrey Goldberg in The Atlantic, that why are we hurting Assad? Why are we backing rebels against Assad? Because it hurts Iran. And that's what Israel wants, and that's what the Americans who hate Iran most want. But then the thing of it is, that meant not directly backing ISIS, but close enough, man. It really is not plausible deniability when the American CIA is organizing all the money and all the weapons from Qatar, from Saudi, from Kuwait, complete with training and more weapons and money coming through Jordan and through Turkey for 3 years in a row. And all the weapons, even according to the New York Times version of this thing, and you can read it over and over even in the New York Times, that, you know, every time we give weapons and money to the rebels, our moderates, our vetted Free Syrian Army, all the money and the weapons end up in the hands of the Islamists anyway. Now, I'm kind of off my point again, god dang it. Point is, so Rand Paul is actually making that case, all right. But I'm afraid he's not making the case that if we intervene now and send in the Marines now, send in the Air Force now, all we'll do is make it worse. He can't challenge the premise that if we put American firepower on targets, that will just ipso facto, all you need to know, get rid of whatever enemies are our enemies over there. He's not challenging that premise. That what if we go over there and we bomb the hell out of the bad guys in Mosul and we multiply their numbers and their strength? What if right now they're not even interested in us at all, but what if by intervening we turn them toward the United States? What if we leave things be, Iran, Turkey, even Jordan might want to work together to see what they could do, and with the former Awakening Council type tribal leaders in Baathist, maybe they could come to an arrangement where they again turn on the suicide bomber types and marginalize them out of existence like they did back in 06 and 07, or at least, you know, out of influence. Like they did back in 06 and 07. He's not coming up with the real arguments against intervention, other than, well, intervening got us into this mess. And now, of course, that is good enough for me, but it's not good enough for the Hawks. And Rand is virtually alone in being, on the level of fame and political influence enough that they even have to listen to him at all. The rest of the entire debate is Obama doing enough? Obama's sending 300 advisors and 275 Marines and Army to protect the embassy. He's obviously going to be sending air power here before too long. Is it enough, or is Dick Cheney right that we should really do more? It's William Kristol and Fat Neck Fred Kagan. Are they right that what we need to do is put the Marines back in there to put firepower on targets and eliminate those targets and therefore make America safer? Those are still the goalposts. And that's because the American people, even though we were mad, there just was not the force to insist on accountability in the media, and especially on TV news, for those who got this wrong. And I don't just mean the hairdos and the personalities, but I mean all the producers too. There are plenty of experts and plenty of media pundits who can cover this beat just fine and who could make a case way better than Rand Paul. And I don't mean alternative media types either. I mean people who are perfectly legit. What about Doug Bandow? Doug Bandow is a genius. Doug Bandow is not a hardline anarchist libertarian like me. He's a minarchist. But boy, does he know what the hell he's talking about when it comes to foreign policy. He is awesome. And is, you know, could be perfectly acceptable for a mainstream cable TV news audience. Here's a guy who is, you know, he's at Cato, but he's not at Mises, he's at Cato, you know? Have him on TV. And there are 100 others like him. Eric Margolies is another that could be acceptable. Flint and Hillary Mann Leverett. You can see them on CNN from time to time. But that would be accountability, would be replace the former pundits with the ones who were right all along. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about Commodity Discs from CommodityDiscs.com.
They're 1 ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the back side. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code commodity disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one free. That's commoditydiscs.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Huh. This is interesting. Well, I'm going to have to take a look at this transcript. Well, what the hell? I guess let's listen to it. And take some notes and see. This is Benjamin Netanyahu on Meet the Press. I guess I need to start watching the Sunday show again. The problem is the Sunday shows, the morning news shows, I just don't have the stomach for it anymore, man. But I guess I really need to start watching this kind of crap again. Here's Netanyahu on Meet the Press yesterday. Am I right?
Look, I think it's a complicated situation and there are no easy answers. But what you're seeing in the Middle East today, in Iraq and in Syria, is the stark hatreds between radical Shiites, in this case led by Iran, and radical Sunnis led by Al-Qaeda and ISIS and others. Now, both of these camps are enemies of the United States. And when your enemies are fighting each other, don't strengthen either one of them. Weaken both. And I think by far the worst outcome that could come out of this is that one of these factions, Iran, would come out with nuclear weapons capability. That would be a tragic mistake. It would make everything else
pale in
comparison.
Yeah, this guy's such a goddamn liar, dude.
Ultimate
Don't he ever
and
get
most
tired
important
of
goal
lying?
In the Middle East is to make
God
sure
damn,
Iran
dude.
Does not have nuclear weapons capability. Because those weapons, unlike mortars and machine guns that can kill thousands and chemical weapons that kill tens of thousands,
oh
these
God.
Weapons, nuclear weapons,
could
kill
millions.
You
say something worth commenting
that
on again,
should be
please.
Prevented at all costs.
Stupid liar.
I think that there are two actions you have to take. One is to...
You know, they could at least try to come up with some new factoid or something. Oh, yeah, I heard that someday they might get nuke bombs. You're such a goddamn liar. Out of 7 billion people in the world, the American right wing believes this guy. No one else. No one else believes a word out of his mouth because he's the worst liar on the face of the earth right now.
Take the actions that you deem necessary to counter the ISIS takeover of Iraq. And the second is not to allow Iran to dominate Iraq the way it dominated Lebanon and Syria. So you actually have to work on both sides. As I say, you try to weaken both. There are actions that could be taken. Whatever I have to say on specific actions, I'll obviously pass along to President Obama and the U.S. administration in other means, not even on Meet the Press. You look at what's happening in the Middle East, and I think most Americans understand this. They see this enormous area riveted by religious hatred, by savagery of unimaginable proportions. Then you come to Israel and you see the one democracy that upholds basic human rights, that guards the rights of all minorities, that protects Christians. Christians are persecuted throughout the Middle East. So most Americans understand that Israel is a beacon of civilization and moderation. You know, I would suggest to this Presbyterian organization to fly to the Middle East, come and see Israel for the embattled democracy that it is, and then take a bus tour. Go to Libya, go to Syria.
Yeah, go to the occupied territories.
And see the difference. And I would give them two pieces of advice. One is make sure.
All right, enough of this lowest scumbag on the face of the planet. All right, here's why America invaded Iraq and empowered the revolutionary Shiites. You ready? Because that's what Ariel Sharon wanted. Simple as that. And now George Bush and Dick Cheney wanted it too, but that's not why the war got launched. The war got launched because of Ariel Sharon and his neoconservative fifth column in the United States. And if you read, again with the Bob Dreyfus, read Bob Dreyfus, Agents of Influence, and read Julian Borger, the spies who pushed for war, and you will see that Ariel Sharon was manufacturing fake intelligence in English to funnel straight into the neocon stovepipe to the vice president's office to lie us into war with Iraq. It was David Wormser and Richard Perle and Douglas Feith who wrote the clean break strategy for Benjamin Netanyahu's incoming government the first time he was prime minister back in 1996, saying, and this is how stupid these neocons are. You know, the way to weaken Hezbollah is to weaken Syria and Iran. And the way to weaken Syria and Iran is, get ready, you know what I'm going to say, right? Overthrow Saddam Hussein. Overthrow Saddam Hussein in Iraq, and you will harm the mullahs in Iran. Richard Perle and Douglas Feith and David Wormser wrote to Netanyahu. This was the policy. Even Tim Russert, who, I say even Tim Russert because he is the lowest scumbag, go-along, get-along journalist in all of the history of Washington, D.C. That's why they all loved him so much. He was the model for them. This guy, he would get so excited, even just talking to a first-term congressman. Like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm sitting here next to someone so powerful and influential as you. That was his entire attitude of life. He testified under oath, hey, anything anyone tells me is off the record unless they specify otherwise. What? Anyway, even Tim Russert asked Richard Perle, hey, you wrote this thing, The Clean Break, advising Benjamin Netanyahu that he ought to get rid of Saddam Hussein. Can you assure the American people that what's good for Israel is not what this war is about? That the Americans are about to send their sons to go fight and die in? And Richard Perle just lied and said, well, this has nothing to do with that whatsoever, Tim. And Russert, of course, dropped it, and that was the end of that. But that was before the war. It was doing what the Israelis wanted that created this mess in the first place. And it goes to the next topic that I was going to get to anyway, which is whether this is all stupidity or the plan. And my answer is, it's a stupid plan. Somebody asked me that this morning on Twitter. I sent him a link to my article that I wrote for the Future Freedom Foundation a year ago. It's a little bit out of date, but still, stupid plan. And I think that, you know, if you go to TomDispatch.com and you look at Tom's article where he describes what the neocons and the right-wing nationalists thought they were going to get with Iraq, this loyal, pliable client state with bases all over it used to threaten the rest of the Middle East, and they were going to break OPEC by putting America in charge of all of Iraq's oil and drop the price of oil down through the floor, and all the ridiculous neocon plans, a Hashemite king or a Chalabi government that is going to be loyal to Israel and America first rather than Iran, or rather than in western and northwestern Iraq, Zawahiri. Boy, did they blow it. They just did nothing but blow it. And of course, now they're trying to make up for the consequences of their actions. He's saying, let Iran and Al-Qaeda fight because Iran is America's enemy. But, of course, that's a lie. That's Benjamin Netanyahu lying to you. Iran is not America's enemy. In fact, Iran isn't even Israel's enemy. That's just a lie. They're no threat at all. Al-Qaeda has attacked the United States unendingly, or, you know, would be at least unendingly since 1993. Now, granted, they're nothing compared to the power of Iran. Iran is an actual nation state with at least a military capable of defending Iran from attack. And Al-Qaeda is still mostly just a group rather than a place, although that seems like it's changing in eastern Syria and in western and northwestern Iraq. I guess we'll see how far that goes. ISIS and Nusra have always been the supermajority of the insurgency in Syria, even though they've been a much smaller part of it in Iraq all this time. But it's a stupid plan. That's what it is. And, of course, you know, go ahead and throw everything into chaos as a great runner-up if you can't get everything your way, I guess. But if you even look at, and this is what I mean about stupid plan, if you look at Hirsch's article about the redirection that came out back in 2000, it could have been 2007, but I think it was in 2008. Basically, the article was about how they finally realized their mistake. The Iraq war was basically fought on behalf of Iran. Oops. So, how do you fix that? Well, according to these idiots, you ally with America's enemies against Israel's enemy. And so, they started backing Fatah al-Islam in Lebanon, Jandala in eastern Iran, and various Muslim Brotherhood groups inside Syria, some of which, started the fight back in 2011, the one that they've been backing this whole time. Although I think it's blown back and blown up in their face in Iraq right now. I don't think that was really part of the plan that this would happen. But it is part and parcel of that same turn against Iran, because that's what Israel wants.
Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Coming up, Ray McGovern, Trevor Tim, and Gareth Porter. Thanks for staying tuned. The other thing is, I do think it's worth noting from that Netanyahu clip that he's saying stay out of it. Let them fight. Of course, that's the Israeli policy in Syria, too. Let them fight. The problem with that is that he's lying when he says Al-Qaeda and Iran are both America's enemy. Al-Qaeda is America's enemy, the American people's enemy. And yes, our government made them an enemy for us, but they are our enemy. Iran is not our enemy at all. Iran doesn't threaten the American people at all. And the best he can do is come up with this ridiculous nonsense that not one person left on Earth believes in, that Iran's making nukes or is a nuclear weapons threat. Give me a break. In other words, he's just saying he's doing his best to try to stop the American president from reaching a nuclear deal with Iran, from making peace with Iran. I'm not talking about going to war with them in Iraq. I'm talking about putting away the fake nuclear weapons issue by getting this deal signed. Smacks like the same old Israeli treachery to me. Yeah. Whatever's good for Israel is what we're supposed to believe is good for the United States, right? They can't ever just be honest a single time. Not ever. And there's your threat from Iran, the nukes they're not making. That's all he's got. What other threat is there? That they helped the Amal militia blow up, or they I guess were somehow implicated in the Amal militia blowing up the Marine barracks in Beirut where they had no business being in the first place in 1983. Yeah. Oh, how about that time that Osama bin Laden and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed blew up the Khobar Towers and killed 19 servicemen on the Arabian Peninsula in 1996, and Israel and Saudi and Louis Free, the head of the FBI, conspired together to lie and blame it on Saudi Hezbollah, backed by Lebanese Hezbollah, backed by Iran. Yeah. Oh, yeah. What a terrible terrorist threat Iran is. Every time their avowed enemies in Al-Qaeda attack the United States. Let's go ahead. That was the first thing I ever read by Phil Jirali. Was he had CIA people coming to him saying that Dick Cheney had a plan, that if there was another terrorist attack in America, he was just going to lie and blame it on Iran and attack them. And possibly even with nuclear weapons. What do they care about the truth? So in other words, supporting ISIS in Syria against Assad, that's supporting maybe two equal enemies of Israel against each other. That's not supporting two equal enemies of America against each other. It's treason. It's hilarious to see Dick Cheney accusing Obama of treason for not doing enough when he's actually outright backing ISIS in Syria. But I guess that's what Dick Cheney would have wanted too, right? When Ariel Sharon speaks, we hear Dick Cheney's voice. And Ariel Sharon said, after Iraq, you better hit Iran and Syria and Libya next. And they said, oh, yeah, of course. and Somalia and Lebanon and everybody. It's not really clean, but it's a break, all right. Yeah, it's a break. Anyway, so and then I can't leave this out. I'm so over it, man. I hate this subject so much. I really need to read Max Blumenthal's book and let him host the show for 3 hours and just say every single thing he has to say to you about Israel. I can't stand it. And, you know, it's just like with everything else. All the things I can't stand, the thing that I hate the most is the dishonesty. You know, even more than the oppression. I hate the endless lies. You know, I personally hate Benjamin Netanyahu because everything he says, much of which is directed at me as a member of the American public, is a damned lie. And so damn him. You know, take whatever pit of hell he's supposed to go to for all the innocent people he's killed in his life, and then put that to the millionth power for all the goddamn lies that endlessly stream from his talk hole. Oh, yeah, Israel is a democracy. Israel is a civilization, he says, as compared to every other group of people in the region. Why, they're not civilized. They're a bunch of barbarians. Come to Israel and then go to Libya. You mean Libya that America overthrew their commie dictatorship because that's what Ariel Sharon wanted? And look at the chaos now. Yeah, good example. Or look at Syria, where Israel's policy has been for America to back the rebels, not enough to overthrow Assad, but just to keep them fighting and weaken them both. Yeah, another good example. And then compare that to Israel. But he left out the funny little fact of the occupation of the West Bank of the Jordan River and East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip. Come to the Gaza concentration camp, where the fact that the majority of the people who live there are under the age of 18 and live under complete and total blockade, like the Warsaw Ghetto, where the German Nazis rounded up the Jews and locked them up in Poland during World War II, where they live like that from now on and forever. And there's nothing that they can ever do to get out from under it either. Where Hezbollah aren't even really the Israeli hired prison guards. They're just more like the strongest gang in the Israeli built prison that is the Gaza Strip. Yes, come to Israel and look at the democracy where no one in the West Bank, no one in East Jerusalem, no one in the occupied Gaza Strip have a single vote in Israeli politics whatsoever. They don't have representatives in the Knesset. This is a democracy like South Africa was a democracy in 1988. It's a democracy like Mississippi was a democracy in 1965. 63. Give me a break. Oh yeah, Israel. They're our best friends in the whole world. And the proof of that is... what have they ever done for us except lie us into war? And when America does go to war for Israel, the American presidents have to beg Israel to stay out, or at least to stay secret. Otherwise, it would be too obvious that we're doing what they want. Not like anyone in the region doesn't get it in the first place. But still, they need that for PR purposes. To pretend that, oh no, we're killing you because we love you, not because Israel wants us to destroy your society. Not because Israel wants to, you know, just inflict whatever damage they can on any of their neighbors at all time forever. It's a brilliant strategy, by the way, for maintaining a nation state the size of Maryland on the eastern Mediterranean Sea, surrounded by enemies. Oh, I bet Israel will last 5,000 years by making everyone hate their guts. By doing nothing but cultivate enemies all around them, and then including among their allies. Benjamin Netanyahu can't shoot it straight, talking to the American people not once, not never. not ever will he say a single true thing to anyone in North America, ever. And so more and more people hate him and hate his right-wing fascist coalition government, which most of its ministers are even to the right of Benjamin Netanyahu, the world's worst liar, who never meant it at all, was just lying right to your face happily when he said he wanted a two-state solution and this and that and whatever. Everyone in his coalition is worse than him. They want to annex the West Bank and East Jerusalem and just force march all those people into the Jordan River. Anyway, yeah, great way to run a country, guys. I give them 10 years. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right. Sorry, I was coughing. Hang on, now I'm drinking liquid. All right. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Three interviews coming up. Ray McGovern, Trevor Tim, and Gareth Porter. And I actually just sent out one more invite because Trevor's only going to be able to do one 10-minute segment here. And so that leaves us one more 10-minute segment, which I want to try to fill. There's something important to talk about here. Breaking news. Well, I'll go ahead and tell you. I sent an invite to Marcy to talk about the new drone memo. They finally released a redacted, of course, version of the drone memo. Crap, I don't even think I have it here. I had it on the other computer earlier this morning. It was Charlie Savage at the New York Times. Well, here, I can pull up the New York Times. National. Where is it? Oh, Justice Department found it lawful to target Anwar al-Awlaki. This is it. By Charlie Savage. He's a good guy at the New York Times. He's a good journalist. That's your, what's the opposite of a disclaimer? It's a non-disclaimer. That's the other kind of claimer. Court discloses memo approving drone strike on American. Justice Department found it lawful to target Anwar al-Awlaki. Well, so, I'm trying to see if I can get Marcy to do 10 minutes with us later to talk about their supposed theory of how they make it true. And, you know, the thing of it is, it couldn't possibly be legitimate. The Fifth Amendment directly bans this kind of thing. For that matter, there's no power granted to the U.S. government to murder American citizens anywhere in Articles 1 through 7 either. Is it 6 or 7? I think it's 7. Nothing in there that gives them this authority. Not sure the Constitutional Conventions had the authority to grant that authority to anyone anyway, but just in case. The Fifth Amendment says, by the way, you can't never murder us, you bastards. Oh, sorry for the double negative. You can't ever murder us, you filthy murderers. That's right in there, in the Fifth Amendment. Cannot be deprived of your life, liberty, or property without due process of law. That's it. So whatever the Justice Department pretends to believe in this memo, forget it. And what does this tell you? Never mind the Democrats, okay? What does this tell you about the liberals of America? That they are not demanding that Barack Obama be impeached and removed from office and prosecuted and sent to prison for the rest of his life for murder. He's guilty of murder. And, you know, in a moral sense, he's responsible for the murder of everybody the military and the CIA have killed under his command this whole time since he's been in office. But some of those, at least, are technically covered under the AUMF or something, right? Something. His power over the CIA under the National Security Act of 1947. Have you ever read that? It goes, yeah, oh, also, they can do other things from time to time that the president may direct. Oh, other things, huh? Oh, okay. And then it turned out that meant they can break any law in the whole wide world and no one can stop them. Oh, okay. I get it. Other things. Gotcha. But anyway, so here outright, they murdered an American citizen. And for his speech. And so all those who said that Bush should have been impeached and prosecuted for his millions of violations of the FISA statute, for his illegal, unconstitutional NSA spying program, where are they on this? Where are all the liberals who said, again, correctly, that Bush should have been removed from office for kidnapping people and holding them without trial, instead of holding them as prisoners of war under the law, or as, you know, indicted, arraigned suspects awaiting trial? They were right to say the president does not have the right to break the law. He is a criminal. He belongs in prison. Torture is a felony. Kidnapping is a felony. Wiretapping without charges is a felony. Without a court order is a felony. Even under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which reduces the probable cause standard to reasonable belief or even lower than that, as long as it's tied to a foreign government or a foreign terrorist group. And so Bush was a criminal. He was guilty of millions and millions and millions of felonies, and he should have been buried under the Supermax. Right, liberals? He started a war. The judges at Nuremberg said aggressive war is the supreme war crime of all. He should have been impeached and removed and indicted and prosecuted and convicted and sentenced to life in prison. Right, liberals? Because that's the law. Right? And I'm not some conservative, Bush-loving warmonger calling out liberal hypocrisy here. I'm a libertarian who's perfect on all of this stuff, always, no matter who is in power. So where are the liberals who said that Bush belonged in prison for starting wars against foreign powers, for wiretapping without warrants, for kidnapping, for torture on his supposed authority as commander-in-chief or under the AUMF and whatever other excuses they came up with? Where are you on impeaching and removing Barack Obama from power, indicting him, prosecuting him, and sentencing him to life in prison for murder? When he's guilty of murder. And when he got his Justice Department to go along with it. Oh, lo the many discussions on the show we had about how John Yoo cannot write a memo that legalizes torture. Not any more than a New York lawyer can give a mobster advice of how to get away with breaking the law. The Justice Department will put a mob lawyer in prison for that. And the mob lawyer will say, hey, I'm giving legal advice. And the prosecutor will say, let's let the jury decide. And the jury decides, no. Your legal advice crossed the line into your co-conspiring with your criminal defendants to help them get away with crime. And so, blammo for you. You're not advising in good faith. You're a criminal. Oh, how many liberals came on this show and said that for 8 years in a row about George W. Bush? Now here, Barack Obama pulls the trigger on Anwar al-Awlaki and his 16-year-old boy on another day, 2 weeks later, by the way. Not collateral damage. And even John Brennan, the head murderer at the White House at the time, probably dishonestly, but still put it on the record that he was suspicious about what happened to the boy, and he never got good answers from those who killed al-Awlaki Jr., whether they were really targeting someone next to him. They originally lied and said he was in his 20s, was a fighting-age male and a terrorist, and then they had to back down and admit that, no, he had no ties to terrorism whatsoever. Robert Gibbs, Obama's mouth, said, well, he should have had a better father then, when, of course, his father was also guilty of nothing except spoken sedition, which is legal in America.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, y'all, welcome to the show. Back to it. I'm Scott Horton, and on the line we got Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst, now peacenik. His latest article at consortiumnews.com is titled "Iraqis Are Not Abstractions." Welcome back to the show, Ray. How are you doing?
Good, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us today. And, yeah, I was thinking, well, first of all, I like your article here about how Iraqis are human beings and it's not a right to murder them. You know, it's just a policy if you ask the people on TV, but if you ask the people on Iraq, it means a hell of a lot more to them. So that's real good. But also, I just wanted to hear your take on what all is going on over there. We've talked quite a bit about Ukraine on the show lately, but I don't think I've gotten your take on, you know, the modern incarnation of the Syria and Iraq war here.
Well, Scott, I think, as ever, the most important factor to take into account is that most of our co-citizens don't know which is up with respect to Iraq. They're still laboring under the delusions that have been put out by the mass media. That's why I'm always pleased to have a chance to talk on your show and other alternative media shows. One thing completely lost is the human dimension of all this. People being killed, you know, little people, children. It used to be that civilized nations cared about that. But lately, it's been possible to keep photos and other accounts of little children being killed out of the media. And one exception that occurred way back in early 2005 was the picture of a very small 5 or 6 year old little girl, blood splattered all over her and on the floor in front of her. She's crying, and in the picture you see the two long legs of a U.S. serviceman who is serving there for what? Now, if you don't have compassion when you look at that picture, if you don't start asking yourself, well, you know, how did this happen? Well, let me just briefly recount how it did happen. There was a curfew coming on toward the end of the day on the 18th of January, 2005. And this little girl was with her four brothers and sisters and her mother and father driving in a car back to their home. The car did not hear or did not stop when it was warned to stop, and U.S. Service people shot the car up real bad, killing the mother and father in the front seat, severely wounding all the children in the back seat. We have an account of that simply because Chris Hondros, H-O-N-D-R-O-S, who is a photographer for Getty, you really have to go to Getty to get the photo, he took a picture of her after this account, several pictures actually, and it just points up in bas relief, so to speak, what the results of these instant decisions on the part of our soldiers and you know, what happens when this kind of thing descends upon a nation like Iraq. Those legs, for example, the ones that are, you know, near the pool of blood and the crying little girl, Samar Hussein is her name, and she's still alive. She made it out of this. You know, those legs are attached to one of the people that we sent over there to Iraq. And I find myself wondering, wow, you know, wonder what kind of tormented body or soul or both those legs are now attached to. I wonder if it's still living and breathing, or perhaps it's one of the poor service people who killed themselves at Fort Lewis McChord, where this unit was based. So there are human dimensions to this whole thing, and nobody seems to give, how shall I say this, give a darn about all this. And here we have Kerry, you know, the worst Secretary of State. Well, you know, you have to go back a ways, but if you look at his predecessors, you have to go all the way back to early Clinton days when he had a decent one. He's arrived now in Baghdad. He's going to fix up the whole situation. And what we have here, I'm happy to tell you, is a dispatch from a Michael R. Gordon from the New York Times, who's with Kerry and will explain. Now, why do I mention Michael Gordon? Well, because he's one of the guys, one of the cheerleaders, one of the people with Judith Miller, who, with the New York Times, got us into this thing in 2002, 2003, in the first place. So we're going to get an objective account from Michael Gordon. Forget about it, as we say in the Bronx. Now, the other thing here is that if you listen, as I do, to people on the scene, Patrick Coburn, for example, you see that things are getting really, really, really desperate there. The Sunni hordes, so to speak, the ISIS, are coming down toward Baghdad. Worse still, the Shia militias, bloodthirsty as all get out, are preparing to meet them. Something has to happen, and something has to happen soon. Now, I have an idea, which I'm going to share first on your program, Scott. So, you know, remember where you heard it first.
All right.
800 years ago, a guy named Francis, he happened to be from Assisi. He crossed enemy lines, went to Cairo, and met with the chief Muslim ruler there during the Fifth Crusade. He talked to them. They had a peaceful encounter. And he learned, that is, Francis did, that it was possible, that it was, you could broker peace between Christians and Muslims. Why do I mention that now? Because we've got a new Francis, right? He happens to be the Pope. Now, I'm not real big on popes lately, but this guy seems to be a different breed. Besides that, he bears the name Francis, and besides that, he's one of the few people that has any claim to moral authority in the world these days. And so why not? Why not ask the Pope, Pope Francis, to get in his plane there and go to Baghdad or go somewhere in that area, Cairo or wherever, and invite people, invite the Sunnis that his predecessor met with 800 years ago in Cairo. You know, his predecessor was the nephew of Saladin. Now, Saladin was no shabby guy. He ruled the entire Levant, plus Egypt, parts of Saudi Arabia, Yemen, parts of North Africa, and yet he was willing to deal with and be encouraged by this weird guy named Francis from Italy. So that could happen again. Short of that, you know, I'd have to say maybe the Russians and the Chinese can convene the UN Security Council and hope against hope that the rest of them will not be so slavishly subservient to the U.S. that they'll come to some sensible decision here on Iraq, because time is very, very short. And people, and this is the key point in my piece over the weekend, people are getting killed. And that includes little children. And we used to care about those things.
Yeah. All right. Well, first thing there is, I don't know if you saw that Vladimir Putin actually offered his help to Maliki to fight against.
I was really interested in that. Yeah. If you have Putin and you have the Shia in Iran and you have...
at least their policy is consistent. The Russians back the, you know, have sided with the Iranians and the Shia and all this for quite a while now.
Yeah. The problem, of course, is Maliki himself, who was put in by the UN, by the U.S. ambassador at the time.
Hey, were you surprised to see, Ray, were you surprised that the Ayatollah Sistani called for Maliki to be replaced?
Well, no, because they're getting pretty desperate there. Unless Maliki is replaced, there's no hope at all for avoiding real major bloodshed. Now, you know, that's why my article really starts with the surge way back at the end of 2006.
All right. Well, we got to hold it right there. We'll pick up with the surge.
Sure.
This is very important. I'm very happy to give you the opportunity to talk about it after this break. It's Ray McGovern, everybody. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst, now veteran intelligence professional for Sanity. He writes at consortiumnews.com. If you go to antiwar.com today, you'll find his article, Iraqis Are Not Abstractions. And so, now, we got to talk about the surge of 06 and 07. This is where the Republicans, according to the mythology, saved the Iraq war from the disaster that they had made it into, and came out and got their victory at the end anyway, Ray. Now, what's your problem with that great story that everything was perfectly fine until Obama didn't stay forever and hasn't waged war on behalf of Maliki these last few weeks?
Well, I would defend it as myth. it's a great myth that it permitted Cheney and Bush to ride off into the Western sunset without having lost the war. But it was totally unconscionable the way it happened. And without beating a dead horse, if you think back, what's it now, 2006, so we're talking 8 years ago, the war was already lost to the degree it could ever be won. The internecine warfare was flourishing, and our generals there on the scene, together with even Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld at the time, realized that the last thing they needed to do was send more troops there. Why? Because as they testified to the Senate Armed Forces Committee, more troops will just give people like Maliki or anybody else in power in those days the idea that the Americans would always pull their chestnuts out of the fire, and there is no need, I repeat, no need to compromise with the Sunnis, with the Kurds, with anybody else. And as you know, Iraq is a terribly sectarian society. So what happened was, after the testimony of the generals, namely that the war is lost, we need to pull back, after the testimony of James Baker, the elder Bush's Secretary of State, who led the Iraq study group together with Lee Hamilton and concluded that the last thing that was needed were more troops, Bush decided to send in 30,000 more troops in the celebrated surge. Why? Well, because otherwise he would appear to have lost the war on his watch. What was the result? 1,000 U.S. service people killed, tens of thousands of people in Baghdad, which was converted from a sort of 50-50 Sunni Shia capital city of 7 million into a predominantly Shia city. And you could watch, you know, on satellite photography, Scott, you could watch the lights go out in the Sunni neighborhoods. That's called ethnic cleansing. But if allowed Bush and Cheney to claim victory or to leave without having lost, well, that was good enough. Now, that's what we inherit now. What did Maliki do? He decided that he didn't really need to pay attention to anyone's suggesting that he compromise, that he give the Sunni fair shake on things. And his oppressive policies have now, well, the chickens are come home to roost. And what we have are the Sunnis in high dudgeon coming down from the north out of Syria and the northern ports of Iraq, threatening the capital itself. I'm wondering, you know, what's going to happen to that embassy that we built there for almost $1 billion, where they have hundreds, if not thousands, of U.S. people twiddling their thumbs trying to figure out what to do. Mm-hmm. What's going to happen there?
Well, you know, Justin Raimondo years ago, and I had accidentally plagiarized this and thought it was mine, but it was his idea back when, that eventually it's just going to end up being the Museum of American Atrocities. And every floor will have exhibits of all of the innocent people that were killed by American forces. I guess starting when Jimmy Carter hired Saddam to invade Iran back in 1980 and all the way through today.
Well, yeah, you know, I've painted a portrayal of people leaving that embassy via helicopter.
Yeah.
A la
Saigon, yeah. I mean, that's what they've been talking about is the first thing they're doing. Boy, we got to reinforce that embassy. We're not going to have another Saigon, Benghazi type situation there, man.
Yeah, so I'm doing the math here, and I get 40 years ago. Have we learned nothing in 40 years?
Nope.
Apparently we haven't.
Now, here's the thing, though. Go back to 2006 and all that. I mean, I guess there's no point in talking about the awakening and the turn against Sauder and all the details of the surge, but the main point of the surge supposedly was just you wait. By this fall, because, you know, they started, I think, as you mentioned, at the beginning of 2007, by this fall, we're going to have met all these benchmarks. We've got to make peace in Baghdad, that sectarian cleansing you were talking about. Kick all the Sunnis out. There'll be no one left to fight there. And then the atmosphere will be peaceful enough that we'll be able to convene the parliament and we'll get these people to become Jeffersonian Democrats and compromise with each other and work everything out and share the oil revenue and with us too and whatever, whatever. And they never did that. They never accomplished any of the benchmarks at all. And so for a slogan as simple as the surge is working, the surge is working, the surge has worked, the surge has worked, no one on TV ever, I don't think, asked, well, what about the benchmarks? That's a pretty damn simple thing, too. Wasn't part of your slogan that by the fall, the benchmarks will have been met? Which of them have been met? Which of them have not been met? Nah, whatever. The surge worked is just too easy of a chant for people to chant, and so they chanted it, and that's how it worked. You know, it worked on the minds of the American people, just like Petraeus said was the plan in the first place. We've got to add time to the Washington clock. It's just like you said, we got to drag this thing out so it doesn't end now, not so that we can make everything just the way we want it, not really, because they knew they couldn't.
And the question is, Scott, well, one question is whether they were so ignorant that they realized that they hoped that this would not be the case. I think they were fully cognizant of the fact that if they didn't really bear down on Maliki and his like, that there would eventually be a huge price to pay, as we're paying this week or next in the Civil War.
Well, you know, in the elections of 2010, Obama sided with Maliki, even though Alawi, which is amazing, Alawi, the former CIA agent, former Saddam henchman, even though he's a Shia, you know, was seen as the moderate and the more compromiser type. He actually, his party won the plurality, but then Obama actually sided with Maliki and the Dawa party again.
Yeah, well, we were paying him then. I mean, it's easy to pay Alawi and then to switch the payments and just, you know, change the email address to the account of Maliki. In a more serious vein, we have to ask, you know, who profits from this? Who profits from a civil war in Iraq? Well, I keep
Israel.
Coming back to this because it's very clear to me that there's one country that believes it profits from this, at least in the short term, and that's Israel. And, you know, I have to point to my favorite correspondent from Jerusalem, who happens to be the New York Times bureau chief. Her name is Judy Ruderin, and she, you know, she quoted Michael Oren, the Israeli ambassador to the United States until last fall. He said, you know, with respect to he's talking about the Syrian civil war, Israel doesn't have to pick a winner. And if it has to pick a winner, it probably prefer Assad. Because the greatest danger to Israel, says Ambassador Oren, is the strategic arc that extends from Tehran to Damascus to Beirut. Wow. Now, we see Assad, he said, as the keystone in that arc. So,
right. And in fact, you know what? A friend just sent me on Twitter, Ray, and I played the clip earlier today on the show of Netanyahu on, I think it's Meet the Press, clips from him from yesterday saying, let them fight. Don't intervene, actually. When you have your two enemies fighting, go ahead and let them fight. Of course, not acknowledging that Iran is not really an enemy of the United States. It may be an enemy of Israel to him, but Al-Qaeda is the American people's enemy. But he's saying they're equal enemies, so let them wear each other down. That exact same thing like Oren said.
Yeah, you know, another little quote from a former Israeli diplomat here in the United States. He says, look, you know, the status quo, and he was talking about Syria again, horrific as it may be, seems preferable to either a victory by Assad or strengthening of rebel groups. It doesn't really matter. Let the blood flow, and we'll be safer once the Shia and Sunni have killed each other off. Now, John Kerry is one of the neocons, pure and simple. He's in Baghdad now. These are the kinds of calculations that are in the back of his mind. He, what I defined as a neocon, is somebody who has real problems trying to distinguish between the strategic interests of Israel on the one hand and the strategic interests of the United States of America on the other. Again, everybody's entitled to their own view or their own opinion, but I just don't think those people should be running our policy toward the Middle East and being account being responsible, but not accountable.
All right, now, hold on right there. I'm sorry, everybody. I'm going to keep recording Ray into this top of the hour news segment here for just a minute, but we'll see you guys on the other side of this break with Trevor Tim and then Marcy Wheeler and then Gareth Porter, so stay tuned. And now, Ray, so... yeah, well, no, that is an important part of the definition of a neocon, of course, is the Israel first kind of point of view. And I'm sure it won't go unnoticed over at the State Department that this is Benjamin Netanyahu's position. In fact, he even said, well, you know, I'm not going to say everything I have to say here on Meet the Press, but I'll be communicating with the Obama administration about what I think they should do. And he's pretty blatant about it. I'll send you the link in the clip. But So what's going to happen? Because it makes sense, if this is the redirection, it makes sense for America to keep on with the Syria policy of backing the Mujahideen against Maliki. I don't really think, Ray, and I don't know whether you do, I don't really think that they planned on ISIS blowing back into Iraq in such a big way or at this time or whatever. I don't know. It seems like their plan is, you know, to back Maliki or whoever replaces him, but still that same Shiite United Iraqi Alliance government that, you know, Bush put in power there. But at the same time, you know, we've talked about how, well, like you said, from Israel's point of view, they would much rather take Iran down a peg than Al-Qaeda down a peg. And that's been, you know, obviously, therefore, the policy in Syria this whole time. But I wonder, so, you know, when John Kerry came out and said, oh, yeah, maybe we will work with Iran on it, I sort of thought that he did that only so that he'd have to retract it. He came out with it in such a clumsy way or something. It sort of seemed like he was trying to provoke, because it's the obvious answer to the crisis, but it's, you know, also something that's completely forbidden. So why not go ahead and bring it up to get it shot down? I don't know if you want to waste time commenting on that part, but, I mean, what are they going to do? Are they going to really work with the Quds Force? To what if Maliki won't step down? No matter what Sistani and Obama say, the leader of Iran, Khamenei, said that no, the Americans want to get rid of Maliki, which is another way of saying I'm in your court still here, pal. You know, I got your back still, right? So predict the future and make it quick.
Okay. Well, you got the Russians and you got the Iranians pretty much supporting the status quo. The status quo is civil war. The ISIS people are coming down south. What I predict is a pretty bloody encounter over the next couple of weeks, and then a ceasefire, and the pieces being sorted out, and the U.S. looking really, really as ridiculous as it has been looking for many years. Let me just finish now by saying that if the president really believes, as he said at West Point, that by most measures, America has rarely been stronger relative to the rest of the world. Those who argue otherwise, who suggest that America is in decline, are either misreading history or engaged in partisan politics. If he believes that, he's delusional. People are laughing at us, and people are making the laughing stock of the people that we put in as ostensible puppets who can't even last more than 3 or 4 years in a place like Baghdad, with a huge American embassy calling the shots. It's the beginning of the unraveling of the empire. If Obama and the others don't see it, well, so much the worse for them. It's just going to involve untold human suffering. That's what bothers me, because you never see that on any of our TV stations or even in radio, in the corporate-controlled radio. People are really suffering, like that little girl at Tal Afar.
All right, you got that right. Thanks, Ray. I'm sorry that you got it right, but you do. Appreciate your time.
Okay.
That's the great Ray McGovern, everybody. He's a former CIA analyst, now a peacenik, a veteran intelligence professional for Sanity. and also writes at consortiumnews.com and at raymondgovern.com. You can follow him on Twitter at Raymond L. McGovern. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our next guest up today is Trevor Timm. He is the executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. Sits on the board of directors there with the likes of Edward Snowden, Glenn Greenwald, Daniel Ellsberg, and the like. He also writes for The Guardian. You can find quite a good archive of articles from the past few months there. And this latest one, well, it's a British written title. I'm sure it's not Trevor's fault. Congress wants NSA reform after all. Obama and the Senate need to pass it. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Trevor?
Great. Thanks for having me. And yeah, I can't be blamed for the titles.
Yeah, yeah. No, we kind of have a running inside joke at antiwar.com about the shoddiness of all titles of all articles published by all British papers at all times with no exceptions. It's just absolutely the worst. It's like their teeth or something. It's just out of control. Anyway, their former empire. They're headline writers. Got to get it together. Anyway, what an important story. Holy crap, is it really right? The thing that you say happened here, the House of Representatives passed anti-NSA bill, if I may define it generally, that was not some half-baked sellout?
Yeah, you know, this is really an amazing and surprising vote. I mean, you know, I think there's good news and bad news of it. You know, first, the good news. The House passed like a terrible, terrible quote-unquote reform bill, the USA Freedom Act, a few weeks ago, which, you know, you guys covered really well, which is basically, you know, there was this great reform bill that was called the USA Freedom Act, and then it was rewritten in secret by the NSA lawyers in the White House just before it went to the floor for a vote. So even, you know, half of the bill's co-sponsors who really thought that they were going to rein in the NSA voted against it. And so that was kind of the benchmark from which we were now dealing with NSA reform. You know, we had for the past few weeks thought that, you know, this bill was just going to get rammed through the Senate. But then all of a sudden, last week, there was this appropriations bill, you know, a spending bill for the Pentagon that the Congress has to pass every year. And, you know, through the ingenuity of a few House members, there was three amendments to this appropriations bill that would basically bar the Defense Department from spending any money on searching for Americans' records in the NSA's massive database. It would bar them from trying to weaken or stick in a back door into, you know, common technology products that we all use. And then it would hopefully stop them from meddling in encryption standards, which, again, we all use on the internet, too. And these passed somehow got through and were allowed to be voted on and were passed by the House in huge majorities. You know, a lot of people still voted against it, but the amount of support, I think, was quite overwhelming and surprising to a lot of NSA supporters.
Yeah, I saw them making excuses, saying, well, we didn't have time to prepare to oppose it.
Right, yeah, exactly. When it turns out that people are just voting on what they think is right, you know, they don't want people being spied on wholesale, and they don't want the NSA trying to sabotage and destroy our tech products and our encryption that everybody
uses. Now it's got to get passed by the Senate. Wait, I'm sorry. Did I let you really say, you know, what was good about this thing? Would it really stop?
Right. Well, so that's what's good about it. And what's bad about it is, like what you just mentioned, we actually have to get the Senate to pass it, which is, as you know, close to impossible when we're talking about any bill, let alone a bill that will rein in the national security state. And so, you know, they're going to vote on their appropriations bill this week or next week, and there's an open question as to whether they will even allow these amendments to come up for a vote. You know, likely now that they know that everybody cares about them and everybody wants them, they'll probably shut them down somehow. They probably won't even let them come to the floor. Yeah. Of course, there's still a chance, and you should definitely call your senator. It's the only way that we can really make our voices be heard in this debate is by imploring them to get these to the floor and get a vote to them. But, you know, hopefully in the long run, this will change the debate. So when the Senate has to then vote on the USA Freedom Act later this year, that maybe that they will keep these provisions in that are actually very strong and not watered down like the House did 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, well, and of course, there's always the conference committee hurdle where they like to stick bad stuff back in, too. We'll have to keep our eyes open there. But yeah, no, I think you're right that the most important part is the change in the debate and the next step from here. You know, the Amash bill got killed a year ago. Well, now, so here it's passed in the House, or it's equivalent, basically, right? So, you know, it's a little bit of progress. We'll take it. Now, I know you got to go quick, and we've got, what, 4 or 5 minutes left. And I was hoping that you could tell me about this very important court decision. I read a piece at, I think, Wired by Jennifer Granick explaining, and it's so important, and I know it's complicated, I'll try to give you time. It's this third-party doctrine that says once you give your information to anyone, then you no longer can expect that the government can't have it for some crazy reason. That was a court decision from back who knows when in the 1970s. Some armed robbery case or something like that, right? But then now something's happened where a judge has sided with reason against that insanity. Is that correct?
Yeah. So, you know, there's this case that is always cited by the NSA and any government agency whenever they want any sorts of records from us, whether it's our phone call records, like who we call, who calls us, how long the call is, when, and then most recently, location. You know, our cell phone emits a GPS signal and a signal to the cell phone towers that pings back every 7 or 15 seconds that gives our exact location 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, which is, you know, incredibly invasive information for the government to know. And they think that they can use this case, Smith v. Maryland, which was just about one guy, which the cops, which they already had good reason to believe he was a suspect in a crime. They wanted just his who he called and who called him for a 30-day period, and they were able to get this without a warrant. The government has turned this into the fact that they can now get all sorts of data on everybody with no probable cause, no nothing, for as long as they want. They've really kind of warped this reasoning beyond recognition, and which is why you've seen the mass surveillance the NSA has been doing. So a court in Florida, this 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, actually ruled in a very influential case 2 weeks ago that actually, no, if the cops want to collect our location information from a cell phone tower for weeks or months at a time so they can follow our every movement no matter where we are, whether we're in our home or going to work or going to meet friends or doing anything that we so please, then they need a probable cause warrant, which is what you know, a host of civil liberties groups have been arguing for years. And this is the same basically the judges are poking holes in the same justification that the NSA uses to do their mass surveillance. So this could have huge implications down the line. You know, if telephone companies start demanding a warrant all over the country, then, you know, this would have a giant effect on people's privacy rights and may have to force the government to rework how they, you know, conduct this mass surveillance that everyone has such a big problem with.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting the way, you know, the different precedents can be made to play off each other and whatever. I don't know if the Solicitor General tried to make a pen register type case back when the Supreme Court back when the Supreme Court was ruling on the GPS thing recently. But then that's what this court did, right? They cited the GPS case that said putting a GPS on a car amounts to a search and amounts to the kind of thing that you would need permission from a judge to do first. And then this court has gone and applied that to something where, like you were just saying, there's really no difference in the reasoning here. If they can't get your tower data, then why should they be able to get the list of people that you called? It's the same unreasonable search. The original ruling back in the 1970s got this all wrong. And then, of course, like you're saying, the complete bastardization of it by the way they've reinterpreted it to apply to everyone all the time forever.
Yeah, so. Exactly. I mean, this case has been ripe for review for years now, you know.
And this will really kind of nuke their entire justification, right? Or at least one of their major justifications for what they're getting away with doing to us.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they took this case from the 70s that, you know, was pre-technology pre-cell phone and basically applied it to every part of our lives, even though it was really only about this one specific little issue in person. And now, you know, it's just been completely blown out of proportion. Great. So it's been awesome.
Thanks so much for doing the show again, Trevor. I sure appreciate it. That's Trevor Timm, everybody. He's at The Guardian and at the Freedom of the Press Foundation.
Thank you.
Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Are you sick of the neocons and the Israel lobby pretending as though they've earned some kind of monopoly on foreign policy wisdom in Washington, D.C.? These peanut clowns who've never been right about anything? Well, the Council for the National Interest is pushing back and telling the lobby to go take a hike. The empire's bad enough without the neocons making it all about the interests of a foreign state. Help CNI promote peace. Visit their site at councilforthenationalinterest.org and click donate under About Us at the top of the page. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our next guest is Marcy Wheeler. Empty Wheel, they call her on the internet, emptywheel.net. And also, she's on Twitter, at Empty Wheel. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing all right.
Well, that's weird. My mixing board just fell apart when I hit your button there. All right. Hey, glad to have you here. Turns out Charlie Savage over at the New York Times wrote this thing. Court discloses memo approving drone strike on American. Finally, they've released the memo. Oh, but it's redacted, it says here in paragraph one. Can you please, ma'am, take us through it? Tell us what we've learned and just how legal is it for the President of the United States to order any of us murdered?
Important background is there were two memos authorizing the killing of Anwar al-Awlaki, one in February of 2010 and one in July of 2010. This is the July one. And this one was written largely to refute a blog post written by a lawyer by the name of Kevin John Heller, who's friends with the lawyers involved, who basically said there's a law in the books which says you can't murder an American overseas. And his blog post didn't question whether or not DOD could kill people overseas. That's sort of their job. He questioned whether the CIA could legally kill somebody overseas. So the memo itself was written to refute this blog post, which is about whether or not the CIA can kill American citizens overseas. And the memo, most of the CIA stuff is redacted. So the stuff we really care about, redacted. It makes a long argument. It spends about 10 and a half pages arguing, well, DOD has an official job of killing people overseas, so this law can't be meant to prevent them from killing people overseas, and Anwar al-Awlaki was a bad guy, and at least DOJ has told us he's a bad guy, so if that's all true, even though there's conflicting information about it, you guys can go ahead and kill him. And then they turn to the CIA analysis, and it's half the length, not even half the length. It's probably not much longer than the original blog post it was written to refute. And it's not clear that it deals, I mean, it seems to basically say, well, CIA was engaged in either a paramilitary or traditional military activity. And this is part of a debate that's been going on about CIA for a while anyway. But so CIA involved in something that's different from covert operation, sort of. And therefore, it can be treated like DOD, and their job is to kill people, so it's okay for CIA to kill American citizens. I think that's the logic. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't consider important, well, it's the unredacted portion of it doesn't consider the National Security Act, which says CIA can't ignore a law of the United States, and we know it does it all the time, but it's not supposed to, it's not supposed to ignore laws that protect you and I, but it did so in this case. Mm-hmm.
Is there actually a law that specifically says you can't kill Americans overseas just because they're overseas, the very same protections apply, et cetera? Is that court precedent, or that's a law, or both, or what?
It's a law. There's two laws that the memo actually deals with. One, the blog post raised, which was it basically meant if an American killed an American overseas and then came back here, that person could be convicted here. That was the circumstances it was written for. Mm-hmm. The second one was a 1995 law written to prevent terrorism. You know, Yemenis would say that our drones are terrorism, but put that aside. And it says you can't engage in a conspiracy to kill people overseas because that's what CIA does all the time. But both of those are laws, and both of those to not apply to CIA requires you to A, buy off on the fact that it's CIA's job to kill people, just like it's DOD's job to kill people. And it's not internationally. I mean, there's this huge long footnote where it says it's not illegal for unprivileged combatants to kill people. But we're holding a bunch of people in Gitmo for doing just that. I mean, Omar Khadr was convicted for doing precisely what this footnote says it's not illegal to do. So he should go free, but he's in Canada right now, so he's probably, you know, we probably can't free him based on this. So that's how it does it. I mean, it's gimmicky. One of the things I love about it is it refers to a State Department justification for bombing Cambodia in arguing that it's cool to bomb, you know, to bomb in Yemen. And it relies on an OLC memo, 1984 OLC memo, authorizing people like Ollie North to raise funds for the Contras in defiance of congressionally passed laws that say you can't do that either. So it goes back to the best precedents in American history to say, screw it, we're going to do what we want to.
It's sort of like, didn't John Yoo, back when he was quote-unquote legalizing torture in his memos for George Bush, didn't he resort to finding some definition of pain equivalent to organ failure out of some Social Security law or court decision from 30 years before that had absolutely nothing to do with torture, but it had some specific threshold of pain definition in it that he decided he could apply?
Yeah, and he
in other words, like you said, gimmicky. This is precedent. Just they're basically playing like mob lawyers, making up excuses for criminals to carry out criminal behavior.
You know, it's when you write a legal tract in secret, it's very easy to make. I mean, in this case, I think just the reference to what the two complaints from a legal perspective, and I'm not a lawyer, and the international law lawyers will have a lot to say about this. But from my perspective, the two big lawyering complaints I have is one, the notion that we don't believe unprivileged combatants, so enemy combatants, like the people we call terrorists, we don't believe that it's illegal for them to kill. Of course we believe that. But this memo argues that we don't believe that. That's completely inconsistent with the arguments we make at Gitmo. The other complaint I would have is it doesn't appear to, although it could in the redacted section, it doesn't appear to deal with the National Security Act provision that says you can't ignore the law. And there's other problems. I mean, this memo was written in July 2010 and said, well, Awlaki can't be captured. It was 15 months before we actually killed him. And the notion that he could never be captured over that entire 15-month period, it sort of throws the notion of imminence, of capture, all of those kinds of justifications out the window. But a lot of that's redacted, too, so we can't make a really good argument against it. Mm.
Well, I guess, so I'm being sloppy and you're being careful there, that you're saying that they could get it this wrong without it just being simple dishonesty. Because I'm thinking the other Scott Horton always talks about how the Justice Department prosecutes mob lawyers and says, you know, helping conspire with mafia members how to get away with committing crimes is not lawyering and you're going to prison. And I just wonder, it always seemed to me like that was what John Yoo did. And this seems blatantly preposterous enough, never even mind a law, a court decision, or anything else. The plain language of the Fifth Amendment forbids the U.S. government from any such authority.
Well, and it doesn't appear to deal with the Fifth Amendment that much, although, again, there's this prior
memo. But I mean, does that rise to the level of a joke of a memo that couldn't possibly be taken seriously or not?
I think it makes a better faith attempt to lay out the actual law, and it gets a few things right, according to the international law lawyers who I've seen read it. I think the bad faith moves that it makes, and it does make bad faith moves in my opinion, although I'm sure other people would disagree with me, the bad faith moves it makes are more tactical, whereas John Yoo's bad faith move was strategic. The whole thing was bad faith. And I think ultimately that the memo couldn't and did not fully legitimize CIA conducting this operation. I think that the memo probably made a compelling argument that DOD could conduct this operation. But therein lies the problem. They wrote the memo to refute an argument that CIA could not legally do so, and it doesn't appear that they've answered all the questions of their critics there. And there's me. I mean, there's other things like they say, as John, you always did, given the facts you've given us. And we know that DOJ was working from an inconsistent record. We know, you know, you and I have talked about this a bunch. We know that Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab was key to this argument.
The underpants bomber.
Mm-hmm. Yet we also know that his three different confessions, two of which had taken place by the time of this memo, are inconsistent on the matter at hand of al-Awlaki's role in the underbomb. They also seem to be relying, we had an informant into AQAP at the time this memo was written, Jabir al-Faifi, who ended up coming out with the toner cartridge bombs 3 or 4 months later. And, you know, they appear to be at least using his, it may be that he was reporting back to the Saudis saying, oh yeah, they're still plotting, but reports in Arabic say that, I'm hearing this secondhand, I don't read Arabic, I think attributed the toner cartridge bombing to other people in AQAP much more significantly than they did to al-Awlaki. So, you know, again, I think the record, the facts that DOJ presented to OLC are probably contestable. And that's why we don't let the executive branch kill people in secret, because if you contest, if you have an opportunity to contest these facts, there's going to be reasonable doubt. I don't think they had a strong enough case against al-Awlaki, particularly in 2010, and definitely not on Christmas Eve 2009, when the first time they tried to kill him, they didn't have a strong enough case. And so I think part of the reason this is, you know, they're still so squeamish about this memo is because you can look at the timeline and you can be quite certain that the executive branch was not operating under the law at particular times. I mean, maybe by 2011, they had made the case that al-Awlaki was the worst guy in creation. But the evidence they had at hand that we know about when they wrote this memo is pretty dicey.
Yeah.
And that's what you get.
Yeah, it's always seemed that way to me, too. Yeah. Well, and I'm sorry, because I would like to talk with you further about, you know, the power of the DOD to kill somebody like al-Awlaki, him or someone else like him in current circumstances. But I've already kept you over time, and you got to go and I got to go. But maybe we can talk soon. I'm certainly going to be keeping my eye on your blog all week and learn as much as I can about this.
All right. Take care.
But so thank you very much for your time, Marcy. Good to talk to you again.
Yeah, great to be on. Take care.
All right, y'all, that's the great Marcy Wheeler, Empty Wheel. That's emptywheel.net. That's her great blog, and there's a couple other great writers there, too. The brilliant Marcy Wheeler, emptywheel.net, at Empty Wheel on Twitter as well, and we'll be right back in a sec. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. Man, I just barely made it in time. Well, now I wonder if Gareth is going to make it in time. Good old Gareth Porter. In just a sec, I'm going to call him. I'm waiting for his icon to turn green. There it goes. Gareth recently took a trip to Iran and to Israel. And you probably heard me talking on and on and on about that great interview in Haaretz, where here's a guy that writes for Haaretz who actually gets it and asks Gareth, I don't know, the 7 most important questions to ask him in a row, and it's perfect. And right there in Haaretz, where everybody can read it, and the whole point being that, yeah, Israel and Iran have manufactured the Iranian threat, where there is no threat, for their own interests and their own reasons, as Gareth shows in his great book, Manufactured Crisis, just out. And then he wrote all these articles while he was gone, and I thought I had them here, but I don't, so I'll have to Google them in a second. But one of them is based on his exclusive interview with the foreign minister of Iran, where he had breaking news, which, as I mentioned earlier on the show, we covered in the interview that aired yesterday on the KPFK show about Iran's offer to oxidize all of their uranium so they cannot enrich it up to a higher grade, which we might talk about a little bit. But there's also an IAEA investigation, what needs closing, and there's another news story that he did, I think this time for The Nation, about the so-called smoking laptop and the Israeli forged alleged studies documents and all this great stuff, the great journalism of Dr. Gareth Porter, author of Manufactured Crisis. Welcome back to the show, Gareth. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thanks very much for having me again, Scott.
Very good to have you here. You're the best of the best. So I'll Google it and pull up the proper title for everybody here. But go ahead and tell us this story about the one that you've written up for IPS News about an IAEA investigation into Iran's nuclear activities that you seem to be, you know, conveying, like you agree with the Iranian point of view, that this case is closed and should be closed, and yet for political reasons, the IAEA is keeping it open. Do I have that right?
Yeah, you've got it right. I mean, the short of this story is this, that Dr. Ali Akbar Salahi, the head of the Iranian Atomic Energy Organization, gave me an interview while I was in Tehran. And in the interview, he said very specifically that they had an understanding with the IAEA, with officials of the safeguards department, as well as other high-ranking senior officials of the IAEA, that once the Iran had provided the necessary information, had met the requirements given them by the IAEA under their framework agreement of last February, that the IAEA would then close the investigation, would close the books on that specific issue, as part of the broader investigation of the so-called possible military dimensions issue. In other words, the charges that have been made against Iran on the basis of both the smoking laptop, as you described it, as well as later documents and intelligence reports that came directly from Israel to the IAEA, according to former IAEA Director General Mohammed El-Baradei. So this is the context in which the Dr. Salahi said to me that, in fact, it's time for the IAEA to actually close this because they, in fact, were given to understand informally, it was not made public, but, you know, after the Iranians turned over or showed, I think it's more precisely correct, that they showed the IAEA officials a document or more than one document which made the case very explicitly that Iran had legitimate civilian applications for its EBW, explosive bridge wire, development program, which involves high explosives detonators that the IAEA has expressed questions about or had doubts about on the grounds that similar types of detonators could be used for a nuclear weapons program. So what Salahi was saying to me was that there were two understandings. One, that once Iran had turned over the information that had been requested by the IAEA, that the file would be closed on the specific issue in question. And in this specific case, that is the question of the exploding bridge wire detonator development program of Iran, that Iran had in fact satisfied the IAEA, that it did in fact have legitimate requirements or legitimate application for the program, that it acknowledged that it had, but it was simply a different program. It was a different set of exploding bridge wire detonators than was identified in the laptop documents. And I can go into that in more detail, but you know, it's very clear that, Iran never acknowledged that the laptop documents were accurate in the sense that they depicted something that Iran itself had done. So there were two understandings that, Salehi was saying that they had reached with the IAEA, and now the IAEA, instead of closing the file, Amano, Yukio Amano, the new director general of the IAEA, no longer new, but the successor to Mohammed al-Baradei, is saying, well, we'll answer when we feel like it, but for the time being, we're just going to remain silent and wait until we get an understanding of the entire PMD issue. So that's really sort of going back on the understanding, the agreement that Salehi is saying was reached with the IAEA in February. Now, the context of this is that the February framework agreement was never made public. Unfortunately, for those of us trying to understand what's going on, unlike the work plan agreement of August 2007 that al-Baradei reached with the Iranians, that was published in full, but this one, there's no public text that gives us the actual agreement. And so basically I queried the IAEA spokesperson, the spokesperson for Yukio Amano, and said, what about this statement by Salehi? Is it, you know, can you confirm or deny it? But instead of confirming or denying his statement, the spokesperson for the IAEA simply repeated what Yukio Amano had said, which is that we prefer to wait until the entire issue of PMD is clarified or resolved.
Right. And while they're in the middle of the talks. And now, but if you go back now, I guess even during the Amano times, is there precedent for this where this specific level of investigation has really been concluded? And then is it supposed to be in the paperwork? Does it say it should be automatic then that they go ahead and close each case as they, you know, finish it? Or is this within, his purview as director to go ahead and leave all this stuff open in this way? Is there any other explanation other than politics and you know, attempting to undermine the deal here?
I think the answer to that is, as I said, there's no published text, but Salehi is saying that that was indeed the agreement that was reached in this February framework agreement. And so the refusal of the IAEA to confirm or deny certainly, you know, has to be viewed as an indication that they're not prepared to deny that what Salehi is saying is the truth.
Mm. And so never mind the precedent, they have a deal. He's saying they have a deal, a specific one this time.
Well, there is no precedent. This is the first time this is come up.
All right. Well, I'm sorry. We got to take this break. Everybody, it's the great Gareth Porter, IPSnews.net, and we'll be right back in a second. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Gareth Porter from IPSnews.net, author of Manufactured Crisis, about the Iran nuclear scare. Great book. Please read it. And so we're talking about, you know, it's kind of wonky and boring, except it's so important and interesting, too. The explosive bridge wires. Oh, dual-use technology. Accusations that the Iranians might be planning on imploding a nuclear weapon or something like that, because look, EBWs. And now one thing I wanted to clarify, so they're saying, hey, we've already resolved this with the IAEA, but they won't admit it.
Precisely the case, yes, that's what he's saying. And again, just to emphasize, the IAEA, given the opportunity to deny what Salehi has said, refuse to do so, and that certainly leads one to have to suspect that.
Oh, did I lose you? It would lead us to suspect. Oh, internet connection problem. Gareth must have Time Warner cable service. Are you there? Oh, I think he's calling me, or I'm calling him, or. I guess. Does Skype automatically try to recall people? Is that what's going on here? I'm looking at it. It's making noises, huh? Negatory. Well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to call him on the phone. I think he'll probably pick up here in a minute. And then we'll talk on the phone and forget Skype because we're having Skype problems. So I bet if I just... Oh, here he is back on Skype. I wonder if he's on the phone, too. Well, I don't know. Here, I'm going to turn on the phone and see if he's on the phone. Hey, Gareth, are you there on the phone?
I'm here. I'm going to go to a different place so I don't interfere with the... Have the Skype interfere with me.
Okay. Well, here, I'll go ahead and end the Skype call from my end here, and we'll just go on with the telephone.
Yep.
Plain old phone technology doesn't sound as good, but it doesn't hang up on us for no reason in the middle of an interview. As often either, so it's a compromise. But no problem. So we got the great Gareth Porter on the line here, and we are talking about, again, the possible military dimensions, the IAEA's refusal to deny the Iranian, the head of the Iranian Atomic Energy Organization's assertion that they had put to bed this explosive bridge wires issue, and that they keep making it a deal as part of their investigation of the possible military dimensions of the Iranian nuclear program. That's an official title with all capital first letters there, possible military dimensions. And you're saying that this is based on, first of all, the smoking laptop, which you've already shown is very likely to have just been a bunch of documents, the alleged studies documents, manufactured by the Israeli intelligence services, the Mossad, and then funneled through the Mujahideen Khalq communist terrorist cult. And then you said these telexes are also just, these came directly from Israel, no hiding it. They just handed this stuff right over to the IAEA and claimed it was real. And I wonder, the intelligence of the EBWs here, the explosive bridge wires, the dual-use technology, whether you know for sure which of the... Was it the smoking laptop or the telexes that
yes,
had this
yes,
information?
These were one of the three major types of documentation that were in the original laptop documents
okay,
collection.
So you had, that's what yes. I thought. So there was yes. there was the warhead, there was the laser green salt enrichment program, which didn't
right.
make any sense.
Well, and not then, laser. It was not even enrichment. It was a conversion facility. It was a bench scale conversion facility. Design, which was the third
which,
one,
and they already put that issue to bed back years ago. Now, right?
Yeah, I mean that simply made no sense whatsoever. It never made sense at all. And in my book, I show that the real function of that was to link this Iranian company to the alleged nuclear weapons program by having them supposedly be the one that designed this conversion facility. For conversion bench scale flow sheet is what it was, and the way they did it was to, because there was an actual letter from a high tech company to the Iranian company that was legitimate. It was a real letter, had nothing to do with the covert nuclear weapons program. It had to do with something entirely different. But there was handwriting on it from some mysterious source that suggested or mentioned the individual or individuals who had supposedly were in charge of the part of this covert nuclear weapons program that had to do with redesigning the reentry vehicle. So that was the reason for having that. Otherwise, it made no sense whatsoever for that to be part of this.
Right. Yeah, it makes sense, too, just as a dot to be connected, because why enrich or convert to uranium tetrafluoride when you need uranium hexafluoride, a gas, not a it looks like they call it green salt because it's like the texture of salt, right? The tetrafluoride. You got to get the hexafluoride in order to put it in your centrifuge. And they already had a conversion facility making the uranium hexafluoride gas up and running at Isfahan, or however you pronounce that, the whole time. And, again, safeguarded by the IAEA all along.
Right, and they had worked on that, on the design, for years and years. They'd tested it. They'd made all kinds of investigations into what would be the best kind of design, and they finally decided that was the best one. So, you know, there was no sense whatsoever in this. And furthermore, as I point out in the book, there were all kinds of technical flaws in this. Even in this one or two page, I've forgotten, was it one or two pages, this flow sheet, very simple flow sheet, there were all kinds of technical glitches in it, which gave away the fact that this was clearly done by somebody who was not really the top flight technical scientific person that supposedly was involved in this program.
All right, now when it comes to these explosive bridge wires, you say that they admit that they have explosive bridge wires, but they have another explanation. What is that explanation, and why do you believe it?
Well, you know, first of all, one has to understand that EBW technology is a very common part of all kinds of missiles, ballistic missiles, and particularly ballistic missiles for anti-ship purposes. And of course, Iran, one of Iran's key defense systems is the anti-ship missile. It's exactly what the U.S. Navy is most afraid of, as far as Iran's concerned. That's one of the reasons that the Pentagon, and particularly the U.S. Navy, have been so wary about the whole idea of getting into a military conflict with Iran. So anti-ship missiles involve EBW detonators. And there's no question that Iran has anti-ship missiles and therefore has applied EBW technology to their conventional defense sector. But, of course, they're not going to turn over evidence of their, you know, provide the technical papers on their anti-ship missiles to the IAEA. That's simply not going to happen. And in fact, back in 2008, the IAEA was demanding that Iran turn over both blueprints for its Shahab 3 missile and to give them technical papers that show that Iran was actually using the EBW for a different purpose. And so I think that was the reason that Iran stopped cooperating with the IAEA in 2008 on its investigation into the so-called, at that point, alleged studies. Later on, they called it a possible military dimension. And only later did Iran finally, you know, come up with this evidence. I think they were able to turn over evidence of civilian need for EBW technology as well, because it's useful in the mining sector, which, of course, is very important in Iran. But, I mean, they chose to hold on to this until they thought they had a deal with the IAEA that would actually result in, or could result in, ending the investigation of Iran so that there would be something they would get in return for turning over this information. But we now see that the IAEA is still up to its old game.
Well, and do they have anything else besides this case to keep running with if they close this file?
Well, I mean, this was, of course, the first one, the first issue on the list of issues to be resolved in the February framework agreement. I'm assuming that because back in 2012, when they first started negotiating with the IAEA, that is, Iran started negotiating with the IAEA, I was shown the partial negotiating text, partially completed negotiating text by the Iranian ambassador to the IAEA, and it showed very clearly that the EBW issue was the first one to be resolved. And so in addition to that, what they've got left essentially is the big one, of course, is the reentry vehicle studies.
Right, which you've already debunked as forgeries.
I've debunked, and I think it's very clear that there's something fundamentally wrong with those documents. It just doesn't add up. Again, technical problems with it, as well as the fact that it was the wrong missile being shown in those papers.
All right, y'all. That's the great Gareth Porter. Thanks again for your time, Gareth. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Scott.
And that's it for the show. See y'all tomorrow.